HBO. HBO Sports Documentaries. In black and white footage, a baseball player hits a ball. HBO Sports Documentaries presents.
This is going to go away back and gone over the left field wall. Line drive to center. Ball was well hit. But Willie Mays picks up two home runs here in the sixth inning.
Willie Mays is arguably one of the greatest, if not the greatest, player in the history of Major League Baseball.
Mays changed the way the game was played when Willie stepped on the field. It was like going to see Michael Jordan, Muhammad.
He's an American icon, a beloved figure.
He was a gigantic star. It's just hard to quantify it.
But I think it's critical to understand who and what Willie Mays is.
A team photo appears.
Willie Mays came out of segregated baseball in America.
The expectation that he would shut up, don't raise any issues, especially if they have to do with race, just go out and play ball. Willie fulfilled that phenomenally to such an extent that he actually drew criticism. You got to stand up and do more. You got to stand up and speak out. Willie didn't want any part of that.
The words were hurtful to Willie.
He's a really complicated figure, kind of a fascinating figure.
It doesn't diminish his status as the greatest baseball player ever. For a black man to have done what he did at the time that he did it, maybe that's enough.
Mays sits in a recliner.
Are you Willie Mays, the greatest baseball player of all time?
A title. Say hey, Willie Mays. Barry Bonds, Willie's godson and 14-time MLB All-Star.
Willie's always going to be the godfather. You know, my dad passed away 2003. I had Willie. I never played a game without either one of them in my entire lifetime. We were in spring training. I was hitting towering home runs, like towering balls that were going like this. And Willie said that, "You're going to be in a slump, boy." And I said, "Why?" He said, "The ball should never do this. That ball needs to go boom. That ball needs to come off your bat. That's."
M-A-Y-S spells bye-bye, baby. The slugger opened the 61 season belting four homers in one game. Only nine ball players have ever accomplished the feat. From there, Mays becomes the highest-paid ball player in history.
35-year-old Mays hit 52 homers and earned the Most Valuable Player award. His 535th career home run tops Jimmy Fox and gives Mays sole possession of second place in total home runs hit. Only Babe Ruth has blasted more four-baggers than Willie.
A sign reads, San Francisco Giants.
Drive to deep left center field. It's gone. It's a home run. Number 599 of Mays' career.
That one is way back.
Willie Mays joined the great Babe Ruth as the only players to hit 600 home runs.
0-2, Wagoner delivers. Mays hits it in the left. Willie Mays has done it again. He has brought the baseball world to a standstill.
He is the most spectacular baseball player that ever played.
Reggie Jackson, Hall of Fame outfielder, 1967 to 1987. Willie Mays whacks a baseball and sprints off. Dr. Todd Boyd, cultural historian.
Willie excelled. He ran bases. People talk about how fast he could get from first to third. Stealing home. Catching the ball, like, you know, we're going to put a little something on it, like right here. So when you think about all that, he dominated the entirety of the game.
Many of Mays' former teammates were there as they honored Willie Mays as the greatest Giant ever.
I mean, he put out over 7,000 baseball players playing center field. That's the deepest part of the stadium. 660 home runs, 12 golden gloves, 22 seasons, 24 All-Star games. But unless you know and follow the game, you don't really get a full appreciation of how great he was.
Why do you love baseball?
First of all, baseball was a game that you could play, and you could play it for a long time. I picked baseball because I could play it every day. It was fun. Oh, I learned baseball when I was about four or five. When I was a young man coming up, my father and I used to talk about baseball all the time. They called him Cat because he could run, he could throw, and he could field. And he could hit, man. He's a leadoff hitter. He and I would go to the baseball field, and just the two of us. And he would show me how to do every position, catching, second base, shortstop, because they look for you to be the leader. And we lived in a town called Fairfield, Alabama.
The thing about the state of Alabama in the 1940s, it is Jim Crow America. I mean, it's almost indescribable. The things that we think of now as racist were routine examples of everyday life. White person walking down the street, you step off to the side, let them pass, don't look them directly in the eye. Yes, ma'am, no, sir, the whole bit, hold your head down. Think of every possible injustice you've ever heard about related to segregation and racism. It was there and there in abundance.
My mother and dad wasn't never together now. They did their own thing. My mother got married to a guy named Frank. So I didn't stay with my mother that long. I stayed with my two aunts, Ernestine and Sarah. They took care of me. Then my dad, they used to work in the steel mill. And he would always come home early, like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And he would show me how to do a lot of things, because he was a good baseball player. Make sure that I didn't get in no trouble. I haven't been in no trouble since I was, I guess, 2 or 3 years old.
Babe Ruth used to say, start a boy young. Teach him to play ball when he's 4 years old. In the spring of any year, a boy with a bat and a ball is secretly to his father, a major leaguer. So it was with Willie and his dad.
Well, when I first started playing ball with my father about 5 or 6 years old, he was playing semi-pro ball around Birmingham, and he was working in what you call a steel mill team around Birmingham, and I used to play with the big fellas like 19 and 20 years old when I was about 12.
It's a sport that appeals to all ages. The sound of a ball meeting a bat is a familiar ring to millions of people around the world.
The Negro League was a black baseball league.
If a black man wanted to play baseball, he played in the Negro Leagues or he didn't play.
Baseball did not want black players to participate in the league. And so concurrently, there was a league of black teams from around the country with the best black players, black owners. Everything about it was black. It was reality in segregated America.
It's a game where the Negro athlete of today and yesteryear has left a bright mark.
When I got to be in high school, I was already playing professional ball, but I couldn't say that. They could give me money under the table. And I went home, and I gave it to my aunts. Sometimes I make $1,000, sometimes I make $2,000. But I had to come home, and my aunts would give me a couple of dollars back to put in my pocket so I could go to the movie, take the girl out, or whoever it may be.
I remember him as Buck Dust. That was his nickname. My dad, he was with the Birmingham Black Barons in the old Negro League. He was first baseman, he was the second baseman, and he was the manager. When Dad went to talk to Mays' father about Mays playing, Mays' father knew that my dad would take good care of Buck Dust in his professional life, you know, try to keep him straight and everything. Dad was a straight shooter.
Popper Davis is like the godfather of black baseball in Birmingham. He helped usher Willie Mays onto the team, was a mentor for Willie, and a mentor for a lot of the black Birmingham kids that wanted to play baseball.
Gerald Watkins, chairman of Friends in Rickwood Field.
They played in this ballpark. Rickwood Field, America's oldest baseball park.
Rickwood Field, Birmingham.
And the last park to play home to a Negro League team.
Here's your starting lineup. Leading off at playing center field, Coon, Popper, Bell.
The greatest baseball players of that time played in the Negro League. Many of those players would have been great in Major League Baseball had they been given the opportunity, but of course not until Jackie Robinson does that happen.
If you didn't leave church early, you didn't get a seat in Rickwood when the Black Barons played.
When I played with the Birmingham Barons, the guy that really helped me, actually was three guys. Piper Davis was the manager, Arlen Wilson was the shortstop, and Bill Greason was the pitcher.
I had pretty good stuff. Well, I had my career ball. I did about 92 on the fastball. If I got two strikes on you, I said, bye. Because my downer was like this. We were young on the club. We were rookies, and I, being a little older than Willie, I tried to help him all I could because I was a little more knowledgeable of things than he was. We were friends, and we played together in several places.
Willie was 17 years old. He was literally a boy among men in many ways, except when it came to the ball field.
Players, get ready for a game.
Now, when I was a young boy, at the age of 5, my mother said, gonna be the greatest man alive.
The other guys are husbands, fathers, steel workers, more mature men, and yet Willie's a kid. And he had a youthful exuberance. They say he brought a lot of excitement to the team and probably is the reason they won their championship in 1948.
In a reenactment, a player in a number 8 jersey slides into home base.
At the end of the day, Piper came to me and he says, what did you learn today? And I had to tell him what I learned, how I learned it, and can you do it tomorrow? Yeah, man, I can do it tomorrow.
Reverend William Greason.
When he played, he was a center fielder. So he would tell our left fielder and right fielder, don't come nowhere in here. You go from where you are to the line. And everything else I'll take care of. Oh, he was tremendous. He was a great young ball player.
So while Willie Mays, as a 17-year-old, hit one home run for the Birmingham Black Barons, he was, by the end of the season, the starting center fielder for this Black Barons team that went all the way to the Negro League World Series and actually got a game-winning hit in one of those games.
John Shea, Willie Mays' biographer. Now, Willie sits in an armchair surrounded by memorabilia.
Do you remember when Jackie Robinson entered the Major League?
A photo of Jackie Robinson appears.
When I saw Jackie, he could do everything. I was very impressed with what he could do. He did everything, and he could hit, man.
So the first time Willie came across Jackie was at Rickwood Field when Willie was a kid, and Jackie brought a group of barnstormers through Birmingham, and that's when Jackie saw Willie for the first time, and Jackie actually recommended Willie Mays to the Brooklyn Dodgers. The Brooklyn Dodgers sent out a scout named Wid Matthews. And Wid Matthews saw Willie Mays play. He returned to Brooklyn and said, the kid can't hit a curveball. So otherwise, imagine that. Willie Mays, a Dodger. April 15th, 1947, Jackie Robinson breaks into the big leagues.
Jackie hits a ball and rapidly sprints to first base.
Branch Rickey, the owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers, signed him.
But all credit is really due Robinson for whatever gamble there was in it or whatever sort of experiment it was. He handled it beautifully with a fine intelligence to enable him to understand that he was carrying this load for 17 million people.
They choreographed Jackie's career so that he looked like the all-American boy. He just happened to be a Negro. And what that meant was that you don't say anything, you don't do anything, you don't respond, you don't fight back. You simply go and play baseball.
I want to know whether he's looking for somebody who's afraid to fight back. And his answer was stern. I'm looking for somebody with guts enough not to fight back.
That's what Willie Mays patterned himself after. And so what Branch Rickey and the white owners did was to cherry pick the Negro Leagues, oftentimes not even compensating the teams that he took the players from. They never compensated the Monarchs for Jackie Robinson.
Imagine if Major League Baseball had taken several Negro League teams and brought them into Major League Baseball. You would have had black ownership. It would have been true integration. What it was ultimately was a poaching of the best players from the Negro Leagues that ultimately destroyed the league because it made the Negro League teams obsolete.
In a recreation, a player rounds third and runs home.
Jackie Robinson walked through the door, but there had to be more than just one to actually stamp it that we're all here. black African Americans are here. We're all in the league, and Willie is part of that history.
Willie was in five World Series, including the 1948 last Negro League World Series ever.
I remember we defeated Kansas City to get in the Negro World Series. Last Negro League World Series, I did win the only game we won in relief against the Homestead Grays. They defeated us 4-1, and that was the end of the league. The Birmingham Black Barons, they were a terrific bunch of guys.
I was about 15 or 16. I guess they had scouts watching me, and they signed me with the Giants, and as you know, they signed me right out of high school.
Eddie Montague signed me to the Giants at that time. And I said, Dad, well, I'm going where the money is.
The Giants are an historic franchise, a National League team dating back to 1883. For many of those years, the Giants had been New York's team, not the Yankees. But after the Dodgers, you know, they signed Jackie Robinson, and that worked out beautifully. Then they signed Roy Campanella, and they signed Don Newcomb. And immediately they had three players from the old Negro Leagues who were three of the best and biggest stars in the National League. So I think Horace Stoneham, the owner of the Giants, whose father had owned the Giants, Horace Stoneham finally realized, we're being left in the dust. We need to get some players here. So they did get Hank Thompson, but they also got Willie Mays. They sent him to the minor leagues for some seasoning.
So imagine a high school kid who just graduated, assigned to the Trenton Giants in New Jersey, and you go from an all-black league to an all-white league. And I'm a teenager playing in this, and I'm playing some of these cities in the South, and I'm not hearing the things I heard in the Negro.
Willie speaks in a clip from 1996.
Trenton, New Jersey. That was the interstate league. I was the first black in that particular league. And we played in a town called Hagerstown, Maryland. Oh, I never forget this day, on a Friday. And they call you all kinds of names there. Nigger this, nigger that. And I said to myself, and which I think, this is where Piper Davis came in my mind, hey, whatever they call you, they can't touch you. Don't talk back.
Michael Mays, Willie's son.
And that was his thing. If he had anger about it, he left it on the field. That's how he responded to racism that came toward him. He was like, then I'll just destroy you on the field.
So he went to AAA. Their AAA team was in Minneapolis, a team called the Minneapolis Millers. He was just destroying the pitching in AAA, stealing bases, making great plays in the outfield. Willie could do it all. Name a skill in baseball, and Willie excelled at it. And the Giants were not doing that well. They were kind of stumbling around a little bit. So in late May, after his 20th birthday, Leo DeRocher, the Giants manager, brought him up from Minneapolis.
Well, of course, Charlie, I'm very prejudiced when it comes to Willie Mays. I think he's the greatest ball player we have today.
Leo, oh my God. Leo, he took care of me, man.
Bob Costas.
Leo DeRocher was a Runyon-esque character. He was a baseball guy, obviously, but he also hung around with Hollywood types. He was married to the actress Lorraine Day. He was suspended from baseball for a year in the 1940s for his association with supposedly unsavory characters. He had been on the Yankees with Babe Ruth. He was a guy who spanned a lot of baseball history. He managed both the Dodgers and the Giants, and Leo loved Willie Mays.
But when I met Leo, it was in spring training. They had me playing left field. And left field was too short. There wasn't enough room out there for me to move around in. And I caught about four or five balls in center field very easy, no problem. Leo said, that's your position. When we bring you up, you're going to play center field.
Did you have a hard time adjusting?
No, I didn't have a hard time adjusting. I had a hard time just trying to hit the ball.
Charlie, when he first joined us, I know he went over 24, 25, whatever it was, and I was a little disturbed. And one of my coaches came into me, Herman Franks, and said, you better go talk to your boy. He's sitting in front of his locker crying. So I went down and put my arm around Willie. He was sitting there sobbing. And he said, Mr. Leo, and he talked in a high-tone voice, Charlie. He said, Mr. Leo, he said, I can't play up here. He said, it's too tough for me. I can't hit. I know you're going to send me back to Minneapolis. And I put my arm around him. I said, son, as long as I'm the manager of the New York Giants, you're going to be the center fielder. We brought you up here to play center field, and you're going to play center field. Today, tomorrow, next week, next month, and as long as I'm here. Go home, get a good night's rest. Tomorrow's another day. The following day against Warren Spahn, first ball pitch over the roof. And Believe me, Charlie, he literally carried us on his back for the next 6 weeks.
Willie looked up to Leo like a second father, and Leo looked at Willie as the guy who is going to turn this team around. Because of that, Willie just went off in New York.
I think Leo might have been the guy who first coined the idea of a five-tool player.
There is no question in my mind but what he can do, the five essential things, better than any other player of today. And that's hit with power, run, field, and throw.
Willie is a 10 on a 10 scale in all five of those. Hit for average, hit for power, run, field, throw.
So come to 1951, this team could win because this guy is going to lead us to the World Series, I'm telling you. He helped the Giants turn that season around in a big way. The Giants, in one of the greatest pennant races in history, the greatest comeback of all time.
He was on deck when Bobby Thompson hit the shot heard around the world.
There's a long pennant! I said it to me, I believe! The Giants won the pennant! The Giants won the pennant! The Giants!
Bottom of the ninth, they're down 4-1. Bobby Thompson hits the three-run homer. Giants win it 5-4.
Everybody was running to home plate. I was the last guy to get to home plate because I didn't realize that the game was over. We won the pennant, and we just had, you know, a good time after that. And then when we went into the clubhouse, everybody was drinking champagne and stuff like that. They gave me a little bit of champagne, and they tell me that I fell out. And when I woke up, I was home in the bed.
Because it was the World Series. Everybody watched the World Series. It really put Willie in that spotlight nationally.
New York really was the capital of baseball at that point. Not only were there great teams, but some of the most significant and historic players in the game's history were there at the same time.
Bobby Brown uncorked a mighty blast. It sends Mays ranging far back to haul it in. He slips and falls hard when he tries to put on the brakes, and Woodling jogs easily to third after the catch.
DiMaggio comes into the batter's box. Joe connects with a solid blow and clouts a mighty two-run homer.
The Yankees ended up winning it in six games.
The Yankees take the series 4-2, and thus the record book closes on 1951, one of the most brilliant and thrilling years in all the exciting history of baseball.
I had a good year in 51. I think I had 274, but it was good.
So here's a 20-year-old Willie Mays in 51. He introduces himself, and he's in the World Series. He's a year out of high school. He's a starting center fielder in the Polo Grounds. And the following May, he's drafted into the Army.
I, Willie Howard Mays,
do solemnly swear
that I will bear true faith and allegiance
to the United States of America.
I tried to get a whole year in with the Giants, but they called me.
Willie's drafted into the Army, not to fight, but to play ball, to entertain the troops.
Willie marches in a military uniform.
I traveled all over, because I played Army, Navy, Marines, all those guys, we killed them.
And during the Korean War, he introduced the basket catch to the world.
The guys gave me the name, the basket catch. Every time I would catch it, oh, he's making the basket catch today.
And the basket catch is, you know, we're all taught as little leaguers, two hands, see the ball into the, well, Willie, no, I'm going to catch it down here at belt level.
And then when I got out of the Army to come back to the Giants, they just threw that in, the writers I'm talking about. And they just took it and they just ran with it.
He played in the Army for 2 years. When he came out of the Army in 54, Mays came back to his home in Harlem and came back to the Giants.
Drop me off in Harlem, any place in Harlem. There's someone waiting there who makes it seem like heaven up in Harlem. I don't
so
want
Willie's time in Harlem in the 50s was crucial to his development as a man as well as a ball player. He was just a teenager in Alabama, but now here he was living in one of the biggest cities in the world in the most famous black community in America. Willie lived on St. Nicholas Place, just a block and a half from the Polo Grounds, but his main hangout was the Red Rooster on 7th Ave in the 130s, which was part of a vibrant strip of bars and nightclubs. The Red Rooster was a short drive or walk from the polo grounds. Willie would go there. He liked to play pool. They'd give him a table in the back where he could eat after the game and socialize. He didn't drink or smoke, but he liked to hang out there and enjoy his celebrity. Supposedly, the uptown gamblers, they wouldn't let him hang out too late. They made sure he went home and got his sleep when they bet on the Giants.
Red Rooster, that was the restaurant. That was George Ward's. And George, I don't know, somebody must have called him, because every night about 9, here he come. Brr, brr. You got to go home. And I said, what do you mean? I got to go. It's just only 9 o'clock. No. You got to go home. Because I had a big table for about 10 in the back of the restaurant. So they parked my car right by the back door of the Red Rooster. And they made sure that I didn't get in no trouble.
And imagine, you know, your table at the Red Rooster. You not in no hurry to go back to Alabama. China, I know nothing finer than to be in Harlem. Not only is Willie Mays in Harlem, he's the man.
Everybody took care of me, made sure I got back home, made sure that I got to the ballpark, made sure that no one bothered me, because everybody on 7th Avenue knew who I was. Nobody said nothing out of the way to me.
Old footage shows Willie with a crowd of kids.
The kids found out that I could play stickball, and they knocked on my window every day. In the South, we didn't call it stickball. We called it like broom ball. And that's how I learned how to hit the ball. We take the mop, cut the head off, and now we got a long stick. When they bounce and come up to me, I could hit it a long ways.
So a lot of the mornings he would play stickball with the kids in the streets of Harlem, and then afterward treat them to cake and ice cream.
All the kids, they come by like 8, 9 o'clock in the morning. I had to play for about an hour. When I play night game, I go out to play stickball with the guys about 3 or 4 o'clock, and then I go to ballpark all the time. And the kids enjoyed that very much. It was just a fun time.
Can you imagine? The great Willie Mays plays stickball just like the rest of us. So there were a lot of things that we identified with Willie. Willie's first year with the Giants was my second year broadcasting. So really, we were both kids. And I gravitated to him because I loved the way he played. I think most of us were absolutely blown away by his overall abilities. And it was his attitude. To me, in watching him, he wasn't a big leaguer. He was a kid playing the outfield and loving every minute of it.
Mays catching, this one is like a seagull dipping for a fish. There he goes.
This is the new Willie Mays, and the country is on fire because of this man. He just lights up every ballpark.
My dad took me to one game at the Polo Grounds. We're seated down the right field line, and I'm on my father's shoulders when he says to me, Bobby, look, see that player right there? That's Willie Mays. As if he was saying to his son the equivalent of, son, that's the Washington Monument. That's the Grand Canyon. You'll never forget having been here. That's Willie Mays.
The epitome of Willie Mays at the Polo Grounds was the famous catch in 1954, game one of the World Series. New York Giants against the heavily favored Cleveland Indians of the American League. And the Indians that year had a great pitching staff, a deep lineup, a good defense. They were stacked, 111 wins. They were expected to sweep that series.
Text, 1954 World Series.
The catch in 54, the most famous catch in World Series history that lives on to this day, turned that World Series around.
Vic Wertz hit a ball over his head.
With a runner at first and second base, Vic Wertz hit a shot that's a home run in any other ballpark.
Vic hits the ball and sprints to first.
Vic hit the ball so hard and so high.
But what made it amazing was Willie played shallow, and Willie ran.
But there goes Willie.
Willie sprinted back on the ball.
He didn't worry about any walls because it was so deep.
With his back to the infield, running on the dead run, looked up, the ball dropped over his shoulder, he reached out and made the catch.
part of it was catching it over your head. That's what made it amazing. And then he just turned around and winged it.
I caught it very quickly and got rid of it back into the infield.
And he makes a miraculous catch as he stops a step short of the wall.
He sends that ball back to the infield in a split second.
They had Larry Doby. Larry was on second.
And Willie knew that the ball was so deep that there was a good chance that that runner would score.
He had to come back, touch third, go back to second, touch second, and he didn't even score.
When Willie Mays went back for that catch and them 30 yards went to 40 yards a little further, that's, to us as athletes, makes it phenomenal.
Those 6.5 seconds from the time Wirtz hits the ball till the time Mays let go of the ball are 6.5 seconds in American history that everybody should know about.
What you have just seen is a glimpse of athletic genius.
Dr. Harry Edwards.
That catch is one of the greatest athletic performances in sports history.
And with the momentum created by Willie's catch, the Giants won the World Series.
In the clubhouse, bedlam breaks loose as television crews, photographers, and newspapermen endeavor to record the scene.
That World Series was one of the biggest upsets of all time, and television was just becoming a big thing. Before that, everybody listened to the World Series. Everybody was tuned in one way or the other to the World Series.
Baseball, America's number one sport, and one which has a season running for half the year, is number one on television, too. The athlete's audience is vastly increased. Television holds them by the millions.
I think it's important that Willie spent the first portion of his career in New York, because when television was in its infancy, and there weren't that many games on TV, the nation, by and large, saw the All-Star Game and the World Series, and they watched television shows that emanated from New York.
Another great star from Alabama, Willie Mays, led the National League with 342.
And at that time, to see any black person on television was rare.
Well, Ed, I've had a few base hits in my career, but I think the biggest thrill I got up until the ball was caught, that is, was the ball that Willie caught in the World Series of last year. I think I also got more publicity out of the ball, too.
Well, Willie, when did you change your method of catching a ball? And how long ago was it?
Well, I spent 2 years in the Army, and I said to myself, now, when I come out of the Army, I have to, you know, have something new. I said, well, I better practice on this. Well, I, you know, perfected pretty good. I use it.
What is the difference in it? How do you...
But it relaxes me. I can catch it easier that way. I don't know.
Maybe. You didn't relax Dick Wirtz. That's all I got to say to you.
So the whole country had a better sense of them than they did of the stars on other teams outside their own cities.
So here's Willie Mays, the first great African-American superstar after the war. Willie Mays busted through to show the world that baseball is changing.
Willie rides in a parade as confetti rains down.
Say hey, say who, say Willie. Say hey,
say who.
Spank it out the way. Say hey,
say who,
say Willie. That giant hit it is great. He hits the ball, it's Slumdog Man. Hits it farther than he can begin. Swings the bat like a little lady pipe. When they reach the ball, it's overripe. Say hey.
I came to New York when I was 19. I was very shy. I didn't know anybody. I would start saying, come in, say hey. We had a lot of great New York writers would say, oh, that go to say hey, kid, and it stuck with me.
Say, Willie, what you gonna say?
Say hey.
1958 will always be remembered as the year Major League Baseball came to the West Coast. And baseball takes top billing as the spotlight shines on the San Francisco Giants.
And in 1958, Horace Stoneham moves to San Francisco because the O'Malleys are moving to Los Angeles.
Walter O'Malley broke the hearts of Brooklyn fans moving the Dodgers to L.A. But the same thing happened to Giants fans.
People in the stands hold a sign that reads, Stay Team Stay.
Giants fans told me the story. Horace Stoneham broke my heart when he moved to Giants, and I've never forgiven him. But Willie Mays, as long as they had Willie Mays, I still cared about the Giants.
In San Francisco, the big city is big league for the first time, and a gala parade down Market Street bids the Giants welcome as they open the season in their new home.
By that time, I think Willie was the Giants. He was the face of the franchise.
I think that without Willie Mays, you don't have the Giants that we've all come to know and love in the Bay Area. It's hard for me to imagine San Francisco being interested in the Giants moving from New York without Willie Mays. He was a linchpin factor in that deal being made.
An extra burst of cheers greets Willie Mays. The Say Hey Kid is at home already. A parade that marks the making of baseball history. San Francisco Giants meet Los Angeles Dodgers, the West Coast's first big league baseball game ever. But incidentally, a continuation of an old, old diamond rivalry.
Steel Stadium, the new home of the Giants, is a beehive of activity as ushers and ticket takers prepare for the big rush in the new era of baseball. To Say Hey Kid, Willie Mays gets his first safety in San Francisco to put Mantle on first and second. Willie Kirkland touches Ron Nigley for a single that produces the final run, and the San Francisco Giants make a successful debut in their new home by thrashing Los Angeles 8-0. 23,000 fans leave Seal Stadium confident that Major League Baseball is on the West Coast to stay.
When the Giants and the Dodgers moved to the West Coast, it made it truly a national game.
But in San Francisco, they did not warm to Willie when he first got here.
Why didn't they embrace Willie Mays in San Francisco? Well, for one thing, Joe DiMaggio.
Joe smokes as he repairs a fishing net.
DiMaggio was born and raised in San Francisco and had played for the San Francisco Seals in the Pacific Coast League before going to the Yankees. So he's already a legend. He's their center fielder.
He was a man about town. He had his own restaurant. It was the Twitch Shores of San Francisco.
So Willie shows up, but this is Joe DiMaggio's town. That's Joe DiMaggio's stadium. That's Joe DiMaggio's position. Who is Willie Mays?
Willie Mays is a New York Giant. These are San Francisco Giants.
They played at Seal Stadium the first 2 years. Seal Stadium was big, 420 to center.
Without doubt, Mays finds himself playing in the shadow of San Francisco's own Joe DiMaggio. San Francisco wants a winner. But the fans don't get it those first years at Seal Stadium, even with Mays hitting a career high of 347 in 1958.
Willie's gone through a lot of racial discrimination, even here in San Francisco, where San Francisco is probably the most unracist part of the state as you can imagine. I mean, they'll shut down anything for equality here, which is, I really respect and love. But, you know, at one point, Willie did go through that.
Willie Brown, former mayor of San Francisco.
I think they accepted him as a athletic star, but not as a person they wanted to live next door to, not as a person that they want to have their kids hang out with. In the late 50s, San Francisco was different. For openers, you couldn't be a policeman if you were black. You couldn't be a deputy sheriff. You couldn't be a fireman. You couldn't live in certain parts of the city if you were black. White people were more honest in those days. They told you up front that you were not welcome in the neighborhood. And it was the same all over the city. Willie wanted to live on Mariloma Drive in San Francisco. When Willie and his then wife, Margarita, tried to buy a house in Mariloma Drive.
They picked out a home, a beautiful home overlooking the water, and Willie was denied. Why? Because of the color of his skin.
Willie Mays was a celebrity of great stature. He could afford the $35,000 or $40,000 that homes in that neighborhood, he could not buy there. The neighborhood went crazy. They didn't want Willie Mays or anybody else black in that neighborhood. Some white guy sold him the house, and then the guy had to pull back.
The mayor said, hey, you could live over here with me. Live in my house till you find another place. He said, no, I want this place. The realtor said, hey, I can find you another place in another neighborhood. Willie said, no, I want this place.
An organization called the Council for Civic Unity jumped in on Willie Mays' behalf.
Did you make a deposit on the house?
Yes, we did, yes.
I see. And there's been some discussion about you not being able to buy it, is that correct?
Well, not now. The guy, the owner just called me today and said he was very happy to sell me the house and the neighborhood.
I see.
I don't know what was this.
They finally did get the house, but it was over the objections of the neighbors.
In years to come, Mays would receive everything from daily advice in the newspapers to a bottle thrown by a fanatic through his front room window.
That bottle came And it caused the then Mrs. Mays to want to get back to New York as fast as she could. And that may have contributed to their divorce.
You indicated that you and Willie might move back to New York after this season. Does this mean you like New York or dislike San Francisco? What's the real reason?
Well, we like San Francisco and we like New York, and we still have a home in the East.
Willie Mays' efforts to get a house in this city was as important as his 660th home run for San Francisco, because it launched the real dedicated effort to integrate this city.
Willie got the house, and he'll tell you that it's not just for me, it's for the next guy to move into the neighborhood. It's for the next minority who wants to buy a home there, because that next minority is not going to be Willie Mays. Willie Mays had the power to open the door for others, and in that particular case, he did.
In the end, the evidence, not only of his greatness, but of the joy that he brought to the field, transmitted to the fans. Willie was about joy as much as he was about greatness. He won them over.
Sophisticated San Francisco lets its hair down and embraces baseball to its bosom. Willie Mays and his flashing plays make an immediate hit. Willie Mays, San Francisco's Say Hey hero, hoists a humpback ball to right. Papko just misses a shoestring catch as Mays blazes the bases for a double. Giant jubilation literally rocks the joint.
They played at Seal Stadium the first 2 years, 58 and 59, while Candlestick was being built.
$15 million Candlestick Park is opened by the San Francisco Giants for the inaugural of the 1960 National League season. Giants owner Horace Stoneham welcomes Vice President Nixon, and with a giant on base, Willie Mays draws a walk.
I think it was the writer Jack London who said, "The coldest winter I ever spent was July in San Francisco." At Candlestick Park, with the winds swirling, literally in June and July, and those winds did not help Willie Mays' home run total.
Candlestick Park, the worst place in the Bay Area to put a stadium, right next to the bay, windy, cold. The designers brought the city officials out at 11 in the morning and said, "God, what a beautiful place." Well, they didn't go at night, because if they showed up at night, it's the windiest place on earth. But that's where Candlestick Park was built.
And for Mays and the Giants, playing at night at Candlestick Park can sometimes be quite an experience.
Dust blows in the old footage.
Candlestick Park was open air. The winds would pour in from left field generally.
The wind would blow it to the right center. I had to wait until that wind hit it, and then it come straight down.
Willie was having home runs knocked down to left field.
I couldn't get the ball out of the ballpark. The wind would blow it back, and I hit it hard.
So Willie didn't complain. He adjusted and learned how to adapt his swing to Candlestick Park. There was a jet stream out in right center, so he got the ball up and out.
I would have hit another 10, maybe 10 or 15.
Cardinal hurler Larry Jackson gives Orlando Cepeda one he likes. 400 feet into deep center for a triple.
You have to go to a night game in Candlestick so you can experience the coldest night ever. It was so cold that you're afraid to swing because you hit the ball hard someplace, but you'll be like this for 3 innings.
Orlando Cepeda, Giants outfielder, 1958 to 1966, Hall of Famer.
The reason I came to play ball is because of Willie. When Willie Mays came to Puerto Rico in 1954.
Players often would play winter ball. They would go not only to hone their skills, but to make extra money in Puerto Rico or sometimes even Cuba back then. It was huge because the islands would incorporate their own players with the great American ball players.
I was a bad boy for the team that Willie played in Puerto Rico. After watching Willie play, I want to be a ball player.
The Giants signed quite a few Latin players, especially a Dominican player. The Giants got ahead of the other major league teams.
When I walked through that gate to the San Francisco Giants to go to the clubhouse, Felipe Lou and Orlando Cepeda was waiting for me, and they gave me a big welcome. They introduced me to each player in the San Francisco Giants, and I'm going to be playing the same field with Willie Mays.
Subtitles appear as Tito Fuentes speaks. If you see Willie before the game, he's fun to be, I mean you. He tells you stories, this and that. In springtime, if you go there, the first thing he say, how you doing? Pah! He hit you with the bat. And I said, why? He said, cup check. I didn't know that.
I had the cup, of course. But he never played with cups.
But I had the cup, of course. He never played with cups. Because in the outfield, he used to do that to every guy that come. In the springtime. But that's not the way to tell me. Hitting me? Yeah.
No, but it didn't hurt because he just...
No, it didn't hurt because he just tapped you there. But, you know, just the thing.
This fella is the greatest baseball player of our time. Mays is in a class by himself. Then you start rating the other ball players. You start rating the Mickey Mantles, the Ted Williams, the Stan Musials. But none of them could do the things that Willie Mays could do because Willie could do so many things.
He was a shortstop when I was in New York. He came to California and he was my manager. He made me the captain of the whole team on the field. Whatever I said, that's what they did. If they didn't do it, they didn't play.
You had the power to bench a guy the next day, regardless of what Alvin Dark or Herman Franks or whoever was the manager said?
Mm-hmm. I ran the field, you know, and I said to Herman, you run the bench, I'll run the field. I didn't have a coach when I played. I didn't have one. Everything I did was on my own.
And I told him, I said, man, I don't know if I could do that. Yes, you can. You do whatever you want to do on the field, and I'll take care of the rest of it.
You just had a sense of the game.
The rule that we had when I played, this one hand, it go left or right. Anytime that hand move, you got to move. That's the only rule we ever had in the outfield. Now, if you didn't see that, you didn't play the next day. Very simple.
Willie was the leader of our team. Yeah, it was no question about it. We didn't have nobody in the team that could lead us the way that Willie did.
So we started gelling very quickly. All the guys began to play together, not no one man playing this, one man playing that. I wanted 9 guys on that field to play together. That's all I wanted. Now, once we play together, we can win.
Orlando Cepeda hammers the ball into deep right center. Mays trots home from third, and Cepeda pulls up at second base with a double.
Marichal, a perennial all-star, is ready to take on the American League's best once again.
After he retires the first two, Lee Walls flies to Willie Mays, charging in, Alou dives, and comes up for the ball.
Marichal was one of several Latin players to pay handsome dividends to the Giants.
In 62, Willie had an MVP caliber year, hit 49 home runs, led San Francisco to their first postseason. They had this incredible final week. So now it's a best of three playoff, Giants and Dodgers, just like 51. Game 3 is at Dodger Stadium. This is the year Dodger Stadium opened, and they did big time box office business. But the Dodgers go to the 9th inning ahead 4-2. The Giants start rallying. The Giants get 4 runs to go ahead 6-4. And Willie Mays had one of the big hits in the rally. The Dodgers just fell apart. And finally, there's a fly ball to Willie Mays in center field.
Lee Walls flies to Willie Mays for the final out.
And he takes the ball out of his glove and he flings it up into the stands. Giants have won the pennant.
And now it's on to San Francisco and the World Series for the New York Yankees.
We played good to beat the Dodgers. And we played good in the World Series against the Yankees.
The next day, they're facing Whitey Ford at Candlestick Park. The World Series, for the first time, has come to San Francisco.
Text appears, 1962 World Series.
With the players lined up on the infield, the crowd comes to attention for the national anthem.
I remember we started it in San Francisco. They win one, we win one. We went to Yankee Stadium.
Series tied 1-1.
Willie Mays takes batting practice. The tying run is now at the plate, but Davenport flies to Tresh for the final out, and the Yankees again lead in the series 2-1.
And I started the fourth game. I was pitching the best game of my life. I strike out Mickey Mantle twice. I end up winning that game. And the game 5, we lost. We came back to San Francisco.
They were coming back from New York for games 6 and 7, and there were several days of rain. The worst storm in a century hit the Bay Area. The field at Candlestick had absorbed rain for 4 days in a row. It was wet. They had brought in helicopters. There's these incredible pictures of The helicopters hovering low over the field at Candlestick, and they're trying to dry off the field.
The fans are on edge because the Giants are fighting for survival. Willie Mays never seems to lose his zest or his brilliance.
So finally, the bottom of the ninth inning of Game 7.
Willie's at the plate, the ninth inning of the seventh game of the 1962 World Series.
In the crowd, a woman clasps her hands together and smiles.
Before I got to bat, Mattie Alou bunted.
Mattie Alou is on first base with two out. Yankees lead 1-0. Willie's the hitter. He doubles down the right field line.
But when I hit the ball, it didn't go to the fence like it usually go. He caught it before it went to the fence, but it was wet.
Roger Maris makes a really good play to cut it off before it gets to the fence.
He fielded a wet, it had to be soaking wet, baseball, and he fired a perfect relay throw to Bobby Richardson, the second baseman, who was a gold glover. And then Richardson threw to the plate on one hop right to Elston Howard, the catcher. The third base coach held up Mattie Alou. And the story was always felt that Mattie would have been dead if he'd tried to score. But Willie...
I asked Willie about that. Willie said to me, if I had been the runner instead of the batter, I would have run right through that stop sign. I would have made them make a perfect play to get me.
And we held up Mattie at third and me at second.
The next batter, McCovey, he hit a line drive.
Willie McCovey hit right to Bobby Richardson.
And he caught the ball and short right field.
A couple inches either way, and the Giants score two runs and win the game 2-1.
The 20th World Championship won by the New York Yankees. He's carried off the field on the shoulders.
The Giants won only one pennant in the 60s, but they had the best record in the 60s. They finished second 5 straight years. They were a great team.
Juan Maricol.
We had 7 Latin players, so we'll talk Spanish. I remember in the dugout one time, you know, I don't want to say the name who did it, but he came up to me and said, Juan, speak English. You in America.
He lifts his brows. John Shea.
Alvin Dark turned off a lot of minorities. He said some things, some very regrettable things.
I remember what happened to Orlando.
Well, in my case, because I love music so much, I carry my record player with me on the big LP. But Alvin Dark, because he don't like music, he tried to stop me. And he gave order to the clubhouse man for me not to bring my music with me on the road. If I can bring my music with me, I'm not going nowhere.
He would not allow Spanish to be spoken in the clubhouse. Cepeda and some of the other minorities were ready to walk out. It was going to be a mutiny.
Willie had to talk to Alvin about the situation.
He says, you go and you do what you have to do, and I will back you up for the fullest. And he did, Alvin Dark. That's why I said, a lot of people say, well, he's a racist. I don't think so.
Willie got in between, and Willie tried to tell me, you're a baseball player. Put aside the manager, whatever he say. If you do well, everybody gonna like you. So that really helped me.
Willie was always like that. He was, he just saw things differently. You know, Willie just said, just let's play the game. You know, let's just, we got to stick together. Let's just play the game. He had just a different perspective on things and a more of a outgoing personality toward that.
Alvin kept doing it. There was going to be a mutiny. Alvin was fired after the season. So Willie's a great uniter. He's a great peacemaker, the captain. The Giants had the best road attendance in the National League throughout the 60s. They had the Alou brothers, they had Cepeda, they had McCovey, Marichal Perry. But it was Mays who brought the fans in. It was Mays who united that team, who made that team good enough for everybody to want to go see the Giants.
I got this Willie Mays bat last week. I told the youngsters of the country that I'd ask you to give them a couple of tips on hitting.
Well, I could have used this bat today, Ed. Why you give it to me now?
Willie was so naturally effervescent and such a gifted storyteller and so comfortable in front of the cameras that much of white America felt comfortable with him. He wasn't outwardly political, so that may have put people at ease.
Hey, Sam!
Say, hey,
Willie.
I did three or four different things that came out of Hollywood.
A title appears. Donna Reed in The Donna Reed Show.
Donna!
Willie, what a nice surprise. Will you join us?
Oh, no, thank you, Donna. I just stopped by to see a friend of mine. He owns this place. Oh. It used to be an empire, you know. Oh.
I remember asking Willie about this. There are no black people on any of these sitcoms, but Willie Mays would just show up as if that was a natural course of things. So here's Donna Reed having lunch with a white lady, and all of a sudden Willie Mays shows up.
Oh, wait till I tell the doctor that I'm that little old say hey.
The incongruity of the scene was apparently lost on most viewers, and then he walked away with the check.
I did the Tonight Show. What's my line? Ed Sullivan.
What's the greatest thrill you've ever had in baseball, would you say?
Well, I have two. My greatest in baseball was last week when I hit my 512 home runs to break Mel High.
Just a couple of days before his birthday in 1966, Willie Mays hit number 512. He broke Mel Ott's National League record and became the number one home run slugger in National League history. Giants were in New York. The Ed Sullivan Show was the big national show on Sunday nights that was live. His fame has gone coast to coast by that time.
An aerial view tracks over a foggy mountain range. A house nestles among the trees.
Willie Mays lives alone behind miles of drawn curtains, searching for whatever privacy there is off the field. That quiet time alone. The life of a celebrity is not always ideal. You have to pay a price that quite often is greater than or as great as the cheers and plaudits and the wealth.
So San Francisco was not like the center of black folk because it was not as social. There was no such thing as a black Harlem. In the Bay Area and in the city, at some point, Marguerite and Willie Mays, they got divorced.
Willie Brown.
Willie Mays is not a social butterfly. Even today, that's who Willie Mays is. He was never a player, a street player. He was a baseball player. But being Willie Mays, you know, Willie Mays, he's always with it.
Willie's home, decorated all in gold and white, is high on a hill overlooking the famous Golden Gate Bridge. He leads the gracious life of a superstar in these luxury surroundings.
Yeah, that was the best house to be a kid in. He cut a hole in the living room floor and put like a spiral staircase down to the garage. So it was like the Batcave.
The gold clock says 10:15, and time to be going to the park to play Los Angeles again. Willie, after a night game and a late meal, gets home past midnight. So there's very little time to relax. The games just keep coming, night and day.
The fans have been very good to me. They've been great. Mail has been coming in, but I don't worry about the grown people too much. I worry more about the kids.
I'm Mike Murphy. I've been with the Giants for 63 years. I started as a bat boy. If you needed something, you go see Willie. He took care of me when I was a kid. You give us money to go eat lunch, or, hey, kids, here's 20 bucks. We'll go eat lunch. 20 bucks in the 50s is a lot of money. He'd never refuse anybody. You know, kids go up to him and, you know, ask him for autographs and everything.
When he arrives at Candlestick, the kids are there to greet him. And beyond the gate, his quiet private hours are over.
I bet you every one of those kids got an autograph baseball, a photograph from him, because that's who Willie Mays really was. And that made him an even bigger star. He surpassed the white superstars.
He comes from a family and a place where everybody helps everybody. I guess he's paying it forward. He's saying, people are helping me, I need to help people.
Willie is in the prime of his career with the San Francisco Giants. So many people, not just ballplayers or even athletes, people who grew up in that area in various walks of life, speak with such reverence about Willie Mays and what he meant to their childhood or their adolescence. He was a gigantic star.
Willie Mays played so frequently and he was so durable that from 1951 through 1962, he missed 21 games. Giants lost 14 of them. So no wonder managers wanted him to play every single day. He played to an extent that he was literally exhausted and passed out. This happened three or four times in his career and was rushed to the hospital and would often spend a couple of nights at the hospital where he'd be rejuvenated. and return to the field and keep playing. But in the 50s and 60s, that was Willie Mays. He did not want to stop until he literally passed out.
I think the era of baseball at that time was you don't get sick, you don't get hurt, you don't get tired. Black players don't get them, that we play every day. I learned that from those guys. That was the Mays era and start of my era. The easy jobs in the front office that paid six figures. Black players don't get those kind of jobs. Those are for the white players.
We knew what the situation was because by 1968, the masses of blacks had grown tired and impatient with litigation and legislation and gradualism. They began to struggle for dignity and respect.
We're going to do what we're going to do, regardless whether white folks believe us or not. See what I'm saying?
And that's boycott.
I'm saying that we're going to do what is in the interest of black people, whatever it is.
And that's when the athletes in the mid and late 1960s decided we've got to make a clean, hard break with our fathers. Not just Willie Mays, but that whole era of athletes who found it necessary and imperative to simply shut up and play. And you had Jim Brown, Muhammad Ali, and Bill Russell. You had Arthur Ashe. You had Tommy Smith and John Carlos, who took it international. These athletes were saying, we're not just commodities for your entertainment and pleasure. We are full, complete, and total human beings, and we demand to be treated as such. Said that on an international stage, 12 years after Jackie Robinson had retired. He made the statement, I never had it made, because I realize I'm a black man in a racist white society. Willie didn't want any part of that. And this is where he actually drew criticism from Jackie Robinson.
Willie's personable and has great talent, but he's never matured. He continues to ignore the most important issue of our time. He's never had any decent guidance in these matters and probably keeps looking only to his security as a great star. It's a damn shame he's never taken part. He doesn't realize he wouldn't be where he is today without the battles that others have fought. He thinks it's not his concern, but it is. Jackie Robinson.
Jackie ripped him. He said, wouldn't it be wonderful if this young superstar could tell us about leaving Birmingham and being denied at the house in San Francisco and overcoming it all?
I think that's totally unfair because Willie's always been outspoken. It's just that Willie saw things a little bit more calmer, I guess you can say.
Willie's father always told him, don't create chaos, don't pop off, don't say too much, just put your head down, run the bases, and play the game right. And Willie took that to heart.
Some marched and protested. Some won gold medals in the World Series. It's about humanizing us. That's what happened in the 60s. These people made it impossible for us to be dismissed, ignored. They brought the light.
Different people do things in different ways. I can, for instance, go out and picket. I can't stand on a soapbox and preach. That simply isn't my nature. People like Mr. King and Mr. Wilkins are better equipped than I am. But it's not true what Robinson said about my not doing anything for race relationships. I've worked for the Job Corps, and I don't know how many kids groups I've addressed and will continue to address. In my own way, I believe I'm helping. You see, I've been doing things a long time along this line, but I want no credit. Everyone must do his own job in his own way, and in my heart, my way is just as important as Jackie Robinson's way. I believe understanding is the important thing. In my talks to kids, I've tried my best to get that message across. It makes no difference whether you are black or white, because we are all God's children fighting for the same cause. Let's talk about progress for a while. Just look around out there in the clubhouse. There are an awful lot of Southern boys on this team, yet we live and play together in harmony. It was not possible 15, 16 years ago. Today's kids don't have the hardships Jackie and I had, and they realize and appreciate it. Today, for instance, we play as many as five or six Negroes at the same time on our ball club. And once in Atlanta, we had eight or nine in there at the same time, and Atlanta is a Southern town. Willie Mays.
Harry Edwards' famous book, The Revolt of the Black Athlete, that's something particular to the 60s. Willie came along before anybody knew who Cassius Clay was. So I want to judge Willie Mays as Willie Mays.
Willie's always been outspoken. It's just that those were the gentlemen that were picked at that time, as well as Martin Luther King was our representation of freedom for blacks at the time. Willie just wasn't on that panel. doesn't necessarily mean Willie wasn't outspoken for what he believed in. He believed in what they were saying, and maybe Willie at that time felt they were the right candidate for that.
Well, it's almost unfair to suggest that Willie Mays should do anything other than be the proficient professional he needed to be as a baseball player. Black people have imposed upon them the dual responsibility to not only represent all black people, but to make it comfortable for even some racists to interact without ever accepting the racist response, you're okay, but the rest of you are not. And that's kind of the way Willie Mays was treated. He became okay, but the rest of them were not. And to the extent that he could be helpful with the NAACP, with the Council for Civic Unity, with all the other organizations, and with individuals like Willie Brown, the upcoming lawyer, politician, Willie Mays was helpful. And we all are not going to be Muhammad Ali.
Willie did things for people behind the scenes, in the dugout, in the clubhouse, at his home. So I spoke with Joe Morgan, Hank Aaron, Frank Robinson, Maury Wills. All of them to a man said, it's wrong to say that Willie didn't do enough because he was there for me. He was there for us. He opened the door for us. And he did so much more than people give him credit for.
I met Willie Mays in spring training in 1968. And he came out of the Giants dugout. And he, where's this Reggie Jackson at? This Reggie Jackson kid. I want to see this kid, Reggie Jackson. They tell me he's a great player. He's got a lot of power too. Where's this kid, Reggie Jackson? You know, I was the Arizona State kid. He wanted to introduce himself to me, and I was absolutely thrilled. I learned so much from Willie.
As Willie started getting up there in years, every time there would be a young outfielder who had promise, there was always talk of him being the next Willie Mays. Bobby Bonds, that was the guy they really thought could really be the next Willie Mays.
Bobby Bonds is off and running.
He had tremendous speed, tremendous power, great base stealer. He could do it all.
Bonds gives the Giants one of the best defensive outfields ever assembled. And he can do the impossible.
Bobby was a complete player. Bobby can do it all.
Willie had a locker. And nobody was next to Willie, but only special people that he wanted. So we put Bobby next to Willie, and that's how they became best of friends.
Willie took him under his wing.
I grew up with Bobby. The Bonzes were the heroes in our town. I was always with him and my dad, because my dad was always Bobby's coach. Bobby was the man. He introduced me to Willie Mays. I told him I liked his glove that he had on. It was a kangaroo glove. And Willie took it out of his hand and gave it to me. And so I felt a closeness to, you know, to Willie, and definitely always a closeness, you know, to Bobby. And, you know, Willie helped Bobby. You know, he loved Bobby.
My dad loved Willie more than anything. Everything was Willie this in our house. Willie that, Willie this, Willie this. If you want to hit, you got to hit like Willie, you know, throw your hands like this and everything like that. And because my dad idolized Willie Mays. Because Willie took all the black athletes at that time and he held them on his shoulder. And we as kids remember this forever. I was one of those kids that, I mean, I was obsessed with Willie. I would put Willie, I'm left-handed, and I would put Willie's glove on backwards just so I could wear his glove. But it was my parents, you know, that sat there and told Willie, you know, you're going to take this kid. Because I wouldn't want to leave the locker room. I followed him like a little puppy dog. And I guess my dad kind of got fed up, because I remember being on the field when I was 5 and 6 years old. And I guess my dad kind of got fed of me just screaming, I want to be with Willie, crying, want to be with Willie. And Willie just finally just said, give me that boy, you know, like, you know, and he took me out on the field.
Barry Bonds grew up not only in a baseball household, but as part of baseball royalty. His mom and dad, Pat and Bobby Bonds, asked Willie Mays to be the godfather for Barry.
Barry would climb all over his locker, get in his locker. He would say, what are you doing in there? What are you doing in there? So they used to grab his gloves, and you get mad if you grab those gloves.
There's a kid, 5 years old. I remember saying to him, boy, get out of my locker.
I'll tell you one thing about Say Hey, boy, because you brought up one catch, and then there's another catch with him and my father in San Francisco, okay? I was mad at my dad because he hurt my godfather, like really mad.
Game of the week. Bobby Tolan, Cincinnati Reds, hits a monster fly ball to right center. So the ball goes up. Bobby jumps up, but Willie comes out of nowhere and jumps over him, makes the catch, climbs the cyclone fence, comes down with it. They collide, and Bobby is actually looking at the ball and holds the ball up for the umpire to see.
Willie came out of nowhere, okay? Because the ball was hitting right center, and I was a kid, and I was at that game. My dad's knee hit Willie in his chest a little bit. And I was so mad at my dad because Willie was on that ground forever. I didn't want to talk to my dad forever. I was like, I don't like you. You're my Willie. And Willie's on the ground and the ball's sitting in his glove. Without the glove falling off or the ball falling out of your glove and then him hanging on the ball to have knowledge hanging on the ball and be knocked out, that to me was the best catch I've ever seen.
Two things happened at that time. I got married and I got traded to the Mets.
The Giants, meanwhile, were having a tough time and business was not going well. I mean, the Stoner family was literally going bankrupt. The Giants used to be the second highest drawing team in the National League behind the Dodgers. And most of those years, second best drawing team in all of Major League Baseball. And they would get $1.6 million. 1 year they got $1.7 million, $1.5 million. And 68, the A's came out from Kansas City. And both teams drew 800,000. And really, where did they expect all these extra fans were going to come from? Because the Giants had been the only team. We used to go from the East Bay over to Candlestick. Well, now we didn't have to do that anymore. We could just go to the Coliseum. We didn't have to go across the bridge anymore. It was 1972, and they started trading some of their higher-priced players. Willie Mays would regularly have the highest salary in the game. That's when he got traded. I think it killed Horace Stoneham to do it, but they just couldn't afford it.
Mr. Stoneham told me, he says, well, I don't have enough money to pay you. I said, what do you mean, sir? He says, I got to get you back to New York where you can still make, you know, quite a bit of money. So I says, I don't think I want to go. I think I better go home. He said, no. Mrs. Joan Payson, the owner of the Mets, she already called. And she says, we got you. And I said, I got to go home. No. Your wife is already here. She'd been here for 2 days. She said, write your own contract. And I said, I got her now. So I said, I, Willie Mays, would like to do what I want to do when I want to do it at any time. And she said, is that what you want? Yes, ma'am. You got it. And I said, oh, my God. She gave me everything that I asked for. I can't go nowhere else.
So he got
subtitles. So he got traded. We didn't know. So that day, that was, I mean, bad.
Bad.
We didn't know. I'm not saying we crying, but we say, what are we going to do now, you know?
When I got back to New York, it was just like I never left.
Willie emerges from a trolley onto the field.
What a moment. This is a sensation in New York.
The feeling that I had when I came back was, it just was expressing it. It was just a feeling that a town wanted a fellow to come back, and I think they showed that by in the way they treated me when I first came back, and it was just to be back.
The Giants went to New York just a few days later, and they play the Mets. And Willie hits a home run against the Giants. And he beats the Giants.
And it's rolled back in left field. It could be. It's going, and it is a home run. Number 647 in his career.
Text, home run number 647.
The way I felt that the players on the Giants felt that they had to get beat, they'd rather for me to beat them. And this is the way I feel, all, you know, going around the bases, you know.
It's beautiful.
Unreal.
I think it's wonderful.
It's great.
It's fantastic.
I was always a Willie Mays fan.
Nos gusta y estamos contentos que estás con los Mets.
It's the best thing that ever happened to me.
So, May of 72, Joan Payson has the Mets, brings him home. He was a key player on that team in 72, and he was thinking, well, that's it for me. I'm okay if this is my last year. But Joan Payson wouldn't allow it. She says, one more year, Willie, one more year. So Willie agreed to play one more year. Those Mets came out of nowhere to win their division in 73. And find themselves in the World Series against the Oakland A's. Game one of the 73 World Series is in Oakland.
Batting third and playing center field, number 24, Willie Mays.
The crowd roars as he tips his hat.
Willie Mays never played at the Oakland Coliseum, and he gets a standing ovation that might have been the longest of his career.
He chews gum as he stands before the cheering crowd.
But it's game two that everybody looks at. Game two was at the Oakland Coliseum. It started in the late afternoon.
I played center field the same day. I almost missed a ball in the sun off Jerry Grody. The sun was horrible there that day, and it's always bad in Oakland in October. I don't know how they built the field that way, but someone didn't have the foresight.
The thing goes 13 innings. It's the longest World Series on record through that season. And Darren Johnson gets up for the A's and hits a little blooper into center field, and the ball gets by him and goes to the wall.
And it gets by him. He lost his footing again. Darren Johnson's in the second. Willie Mays stumbling again as he did on the bases.
So later in the game, Reggie hits a triple that Willie lost in the sun as well.
In slow motion, Willie misses a ball.
This Willie Mays stumbled around in center field because he was old and couldn't play. No, if he couldn't get to the ball, I'm okay. But he didn't get to the ball and drop it. He never did that. Never. That game is not an image of Willie Mays. You can say Willie Mays was old when he played his last game. He got a base hit, and he had trouble with the sun in center field in the World Series. I got that. But Willie Mays was flawless as a baseball player. So if somebody wants to talk about his sun game, you forget about the fact that he got the go-ahead base hit to put them ahead with a ground ball single up the middle.
You'll see a picture that everybody points to. Bud Harrelson was called out at the plate by the umpire. Willie, the on-deck hitter, was out there screaming and yelling at the umpire, saying, "You got this wrong, man."
Because that's such a powerful photo, you misread it if you don't have the context to understand that he wasn't as good at 40 as he was at 20, but it's like, no, not only is this dude good, this dude might be the best there ever was.
There was one very poignant pause down the home stretch when Willie Mays announced that 1973 would be his final season as an active player.
A sign reads, "I believe in Willie."
I remember watching Game 7, and the Mets are down 3 runs as they come up in the ninth, and they get 2 men on base. And I realize he's 42 years old and at the end of his career and all the rest, but I'm thinking, Yogi, send Willie up. This is Willie Mays' last at-bat. He's already announced his retirement. 2 out, tying run at the plate. Send Willie Mays up. He didn't. Knowles got Garrett out, lost the game. I asked Willie about that decades later. He goes, "I was reaching for a bat. It was a perfect moment. Even if I struck out, I wanted a chance."
We should have won the World Series at that time because we did a good job, I thought. I think I played to 42, a long time.
A black and white photo shows Willie hitting the ball.
Ladies and gentlemen, Willie Mays!
The crowd goes wild. A man in the crowd pumps his fists overhead with a bright smile as Willie steps up to a microphone.
I hope that with my farewell tonight, you would understand what I'm going through right now. Something that I never felt that I would ever quit baseball. But as you know, it always comes a time for someone to get out. And I look at the kids over here, the way they are playing, and the way they are fighting for themselves, tells me one thing. Willie, say goodbye to America. Thank you very much.
Willie steps back and wipes a tear from his eye. He stands beside his wife, who hugs his arm. Willie removes his hat and raises it up to the audience. Willie walks away, his hands in the pockets of his jacket.
Anybody have seen me play know that I love what I'm doing. This doesn't mean that I'm getting out of baseball because I'm happy, but I'm getting out of baseball because I don't feel that, seeing the way that I was playing the last couple of years, I didn't feel that the people of America should look at a guy like myself that loved the game of baseball and being on the field and not being able to produce. It's difficult right now to even try to explain to you how much I love baseball and how much baseball means to me. I think we had what you call a love affair. I think the two together for 22 years have been terrific.
Fast forward 20 years or so, Willie was not working for the Giants. Willie was out of baseball. This is in late 92 when our group came together to buy the team. And Peter McGowan and I went to Willie at the very first spring training that we had in early 93. And we said, Willie, you have to be part of this franchise. And we want you to have a lifetime contract. So it's 1992. And the best free agent on the market is available for our first year owning the franchise, 1993. And how do we get to Barry Bonds? Well, I don't know him, but there's one person that can make the pitch, Willie. There was a call that was made by Willie to Barry. And when the decision came for Barry to determine where he was going to play in 1993 and where he would play for the next 15 years, he was very emotional and he called up. And I remember being on the other end of the call and saying, look, how can I not come to the home of my father and my godfather, Willie?
I wanted to go home. This is what I've always wanted my whole entire life. And that was really, really important to me. The most important thing in the world.
The biggest deal in baseball history finally went through today as the San Francisco Giants signed free agent outfielder Barry Bonds to a six-year, $43.75 million deal.
And I want to thank the San Francisco Giants organization for talking to Willie for me and giving me this opportunity, and especially Willie for allowing this to happen.
And Willie called me up, and he sat there and he said, I would like for you to wear my number. So I was so touched. I was crying. I was like, this is great. This is great. Peter was fine with it. The Giants were fine with it, but Major League Baseball shut it down. They said that you can't do that because if we start taking uniforms out of retirement, then why are we retiring uniforms? Which made perfect sense to me. I was fine. And then Willie said, why don't you honor your daddy and wear number 25?
So I have the honor of presenting my old number, number 25, to my son and a new San Francisco Giants, Barry Bonds.
They hold up a number 25 jersey.
And tears flowed.
It's like a boyhood dream that comes true for me.
He taps his thumb on the podium as he fights back tears.
And I'll never forget this because we were on stage and Peter McGowan and all the owners, and Willie's there and he goes, you ready? That's when I knew I was a complete baseball player, is when I got that stamp from my godfather. He had an IQ so high, he can see it. My godfather played center field. My father played in right field, and I wanted to be third generation and play left field.
Willie's the only one, and his mama, Pat, that could put the brakes in control Barry. You know, he'd listen to Bobby most of the time, but he'd listen to Willie all the time.
Barry and Bobby struggled, you know, like many fathers and sons do. Dad, of course, jumped in, you know, help them both out.
They were always there for me. My dad was there with me. I was during off-season training. My dad was in the batting cage with me every single day I was training. Willie was there all the time when I was training. Willie was there with me on the baseball field. And I wanted Willie to be proud of me so bad that I ate, drank, lived baseball 24 hours a day.
Bonds with a drive. Looks like number 70 for Barry Bonds. And it is.
If you look back at all of Barry Bonds' record, what does he say is most meaningful?
A knuckleball is hit in the air to deep right field.
Passing Babe, passing Hank. No, matching Willie Mays, 660.
He hits it home!
Bonds home run number 660.
When I was going for the home run record, I didn't want to pass Willie Mays. That was my godfather. That was the only thing I never wanted to do, was to pass Willie Mays. And that was very hard for me. And so Willie sat me aside. And I was like, Willie, I can't do it. It's because it's too emotional. You're going to come out on the field. I'm going to start crying. And he said, you better pass me, and then you better keep going. I did it because of Willie.
Delivers, and Bonds hits one high, deep towards right field. And in the McCovey Cove!
And he said, you pass me, and you keep passing next, and you keep going until they rip that uniform off you.
Home run number 715.
Bonds passes Babe Ruth. He is second on the all-time home run list.
I got to thank all of you. My family, my dad. I was very, very lucky to have two of the greatest teachers in the world to me.
Thank you.
My father won.
Midway into Barry's career as a Giant, his father, Bobby, died. On his deathbed, Willie Mays visits him, and Bobby says, take care of Barry for me. because you're the only guy he listens to other than me. And Willie said, okay. And that was important. For all the turmoil and all the stuff that Barry went through, it was Willie Mays who he could always call. Willie Mays who was always there for him.
Barry sits in the stadium on August 11th, 2018.
There was a poignant moment when they saluted Barry Bonds and retired his number formally at Oracle Park. Willie was there, and he got up and said he needed to speak.
When Mr. Mays wants to speak, he gets to speak.
A man hands a microphone to Willie.
So we're going to get Mr. Mays a microphone.
I have to go to the podium because when I say something, I want everybody to hear it.
And this was not part of the script.
And Willie, take it away.
I don't like to do things like this. But the boy that is here today, he was like my little son. I taught him to be a proud man. Give somebody honor that deserve to be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah. So Willie starts talking about the Hall of Fame and what a great thrill it was for him when he got that call that he was going into the Hall of Fame.
You know, Dad sees Barry as a kid that he helped groom, and I think Barry sees Dad as his family. His dad's gone, so, you know, closest thing he's got.
Let him have the honor, because I may not be here forever. I might be gone. I want him to have kids, and his kids say, that's my daddy over there, and I want him to have that honor. Be something happened to him.
What do you remember about that speech?
Try not to cry, because it's like your father. And that's tough, because he's the world. And for him to stand up for his godson, like his son, that's what I was holding back. And that's the only answer I got for you, because that's the same feeling I had, the same. And anyone who ever brings it up, it's the same feeling. My dad is dead, and Willie is all I have. Right? So that, don't do it. That's how I felt.
On behalf of all the people in San Francisco and all over the country, vote this guy in. He is very, very important to me. Thank you very much. Eh? Okay.
And I think that was the generosity of spirit. That was Willie Mays. And who could offer counsel to Barry Bonds but Willie Mays?
People in the audience stand and applaud Willie's speech.
Whatever the Lord did for Willie Mays, he equipped Willie Mays to play the art of baseball. As some people that could hit as good as he did, as some people that could throw as well as he threw. On every pitch, Willie Mays was as decisive intellectually on baseball as any one of the coaches, as any one of the managers. None of them could do what Willie Mays could do.
Willie Mays created the Say Hey Foundation dedicated to helping underprivileged youth. It also established baseball programs and helped restore Rickwood Field.
You had to experience it to understand what he meant. He was baseball to a lot of people in an era that was brimming with great, great players.
I didn't think of him as a mere ball player or even as a human being as I look back on it, but rather a superhero. Willie Mays walks down the street, and fathers say to their sons, there goes Willie Mays, the greatest player to ever play this game.
Willie Mays was presented the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Barack Obama.
We don't have time to list all of Willie Mays' statistics and his quiet example while excelling on one of America's biggest stages helped carry forward the banner of civil rights. A few years ago, Willie rode with me on Air Force One. I told him then what I'll tell all of you now. It's because of giants like Willie that someone like me could even think about running for president.
President Obama grins as he ties a gold medal with blue ribbon around Willie's neck.
Are you Willie Mays, the greatest baseball player of all time?
Uh-uh. I don't do that.
You don't do that?
No.
Who would be?
I don't know. That's not my job.
Right.
If you're talking about the greatest ball player, I didn't do all that to play baseball. Mm-hmm. My dad could play baseball. A lot of guys could play baseball. I didn't do that to
to say I'm the best.
When I look at myself, I think about sports first.
Young Willie hits the ball and runs around the bases.
So many things happen with me on the baseball field that I could just look back and just replay every moment. I never had a day where somebody would not come up and say, I saw you make a play, I love you because of what you did for me. And it made me feel very, very proud because not only did I play baseball for the people, they enjoyed what I did.
Ladies and gentlemen, number 24, Willie Mays.
Say hey, Willie! Greatest in the field of what you got to say. Willie, no question, number 24, will he amaze ya? Most excited ball player in the game to play. Willie Mays.
Who's the catcher from the Braves whose leg you broke?
Dale Rice, good guy.
Why'd you break his leg?
He got it the goddamn way. What do you mean when I broke his leg? I broke sliding home. I told him, I said, you better get the hell out the way, man.
You broke the same leg twice?
Yeah. He got in the way twice. He put the leg out there in front of me. I said, you better get that stomach back in the way and hold it for a minute. Yeah, but he was a good guy. I didn't hit him too hard, just a little bit.
Just hard enough to break his leg, right?
Yeah, that was enough. Who do you lack on the team?
On the Giants? I'm a Yankee fan.
Huh?
I'm a Yankee fan.
So?
I like Mickey Mouse.
What happened to me? Oh, you left me already?
Oh, yeah. I think you left me, brother, but I'm going to hang in here with you.
Who else was out there that could play?
Babe Ruth.
Man, well, fuck, I ain't see Babe Ruth, play. What the hell you talking about? I know Babe. I met Babe over in Long Island a couple of times, but I don't.
You met Babe Ruth?
Yeah.
Did you like Babe Ruth? Did you like him as a person?
Uh-oh. See, that's why I don't say that.
A man shakes Willie's hand.
See, you trying.
I'm trying.
Oh, my God.
Yo, that hurt.
Okay, we're going to Russell Wilson. Oh, no. I don't want to prick his arm because he'll say I'm cheating.
You kicked my ass today, but...
interviewer, the handshake?
Both.
I think both. I told you to be nice to him, Willie. What are you doing?
I'll break that song, bitch. <next time. laughs>
New York Mets are proud to announce that in accordance with Mrs. Payson's wishes, and at the urging of his former Mets teammates, in recognition of his contributions to the Mets, as well as baseball in New York and the country at large, Willie Mays, 24, will take its place in the left field corner here at Citi Field with the other greats in Mets history.
Copyright 2022, Home Box Office Incorporated. All rights reserved. Logos, Zipper Bros Films, MLB Studios, company name, Uninterrupted, HBO, a presentation of Home Box Office.